Good morning. Welcome to episode 23 of our monthly Meet the Experts Q&A sessions with Sinton's employment team. Thank you for all your positive comments about these sessions, for signing up to them, for tuning in each week, sending in your questions, watching the video online afterwards, and listening to the podcast version. So, as with previous weeks, the employment team will answer questions we've received from clients during the month. Our speakers today are me, Fiona Campbell, and my colleague, Angela Carver. So without further ado, I'm going to commence with question one. The question was, what should employers be doing by way of right to work checks following the end of the deadline for EU workers to apply for settled or pre-settled status? Those of you who've tuned in to my series of podcasts, Understanding Business Immigration, will already be fully aware of the answer to this question. But please don't tune out just yet, as it never hurts to have your knowledge reinforced a little bit. And you certainly don't want to miss Angela's section of our Q&A today. To answer this question, I wanted to give you a bit of background in terms of right to work checks and then address the question more specifically. First of all, what's their purpose? As I'm sure you'll all be aware, it's illegal for employers to employ someone who doesn't have the right to work in the UK. Employers who do employ someone illegally can be subject to hefty fines and, in the worst cases, a custodial sentence. Therefore, employers want to ensure that their employees all have the right to work in the UK. Undertaking the appropriate checks will not only provide the employer with evidence that their staff have this, but if the checks were undertaken correctly, then, and if an employee was found to be an illegal worker, the fact that the checks were undertaken will act as what is known as a statutory excuse or defence for the employer. This is subject to the caveat that the checks were properly undertaken and that the ID provided could not obviously have been identified as fake. So once we know why we're doing right to work checks, what's the right way of doing them? The check should be undertaken generally before you employ someone to ensure that they are legally allowed to do the work in question. However, and this is where we come to the question in hand today, the current exemption to checks having to be done, or exception rather, to checks having to be done prior to the employee starting relates to European staff. Prior to 1st of July this year, employees from the EU or EEA will have been entitled to work in the UK with just an EU passport. However, as of 1st of July, subject to any extensions, this will not suffice. An additional evidence that they have the appropriate settled status will need to be acquired. Therefore, for these staff, it's crucial that a new check is undertaken as soon as possible if you haven't done it already. In terms of practical advice in undertaking the checks, there are two methods, manual and online. The online check is the one relevant to European staff. However, for completeness, I'll cover both types. In relation to a manual document-based right to work check, there are three steps you need to take. Step one is obtaining the appropriate original document. There's a list of the acceptable documents broken down into list A, which includes documents that only need to be provided once, or list B documents, which are limited by time. In other words, they expire and further evidence will need to be obtained at the appropriate time. Step two is actually checking the document. This means checking that they are genuine and that the person is the person on the documentation and is allowed to undertake the type of work you're offering to them. You need to check photos and dates of birth are consistent, expiry dates haven't passed, whether there are any restrictions on the right to work, that the documents are or appear to be at least genuine, and the reasons for any differences in names can be explained by providing evidence, such as marriage certificates. Step three is making a copy of the documents and retaining a secure record of the date on which you made the check. If you're writing the date on the copy, then it should also state that this date was the date on which the check was made. The date alone will not suffice. You should be aware that copies should be kept for 2 years after the employee leaves. In addition to the manual document check, for some prospective employees, there will now also be an online right to work check-in service. As I mentioned, this is particularly relevant for EU or EE workers who have registered their settled status. It can also be used for migrant workers who hold biometric residence permits or cards. Again, there's a three-step process. Step one is to use the online checking service. To do this, you as the employer should obtain a share code from the employee, which, when entered into the online system with the individual's date of birth, enables you as the employer to review the employee or prospective employee's right to work record. Like with the manual right to work check, the second step is to check the information you receive. If the person has the right to work, then a message will appear stating their name and that they have the right to work. There'll also be a photo of the individual. With the individual present, you should check that the photo matches the person. Step three is again like the manual step three in that you should retain evidence of the online check. You should retain a copy of the online profile page containing their photo and the confirmation that they have the right to work. You should save the file as a PDF or HTML and retain it for 2 years. So to summarise, if you have any employees whose ID was a European passport, please ensure you undertake a new right to work check as a matter of urgency. Now I'll pass you to Angela to address question two.
Thanks, Fiona. Sorry, I was just finishing my my drink of tea there. So sorry for the quick 2 second lag. We've had quite a few questions this month about employees returning to work. So what I've tried to do is bunch together as many as possible. So as of the 19th of July 2021, the burden for managing employees in the workplace has shifted from the government to you as now as an employer. So the first thing we need to look at is the risk assessment. So at this point in the COVID-19 saga, I might be teaching you how to suck eggs, but hopefully all businesses will have a COVID-19 assessment in place. But given a lot of workplaces have remained partially closed, things might have changed, and it's always a good idea to refresh this. Can I have the next slide, David? A risk assessment must consider who's at risk, be this staff, customers, contractors. They need to identify any situations that might lead to the transmission of COVID-19. So you need to look at things like shared equipment and facilities. Then you need to determine the likelihood of somebody being exposed to COVID-19. And then finally determine what needs to be put in place to remove or control the risk. So notwithstanding the removal of masks and the removal of the social distancing guidance, a risk assessment might still lead to you as an employer putting measures in place to control a risk. Now, these could be things like a phased return, home office hybrid working, which I'm going to come on to, the reconfiguration of your workplaces, additional cleaning measures, availability of sanitizer and cleaning products, and amendments to working hours. But I will say to be mindful about this one. So if I could have the next slide, David. Sorry, I'm asking David for the next slide because at 4:45 last night, I decided that I would introduce slides into this Q&A. So so David, our head of marketing, dutifully clicking through the slides for me. So we don't usually dissect case law on these Q&As, but an interesting case was determined by the Employment Appeals Tribunal on the 22nd of June 2021 regarding amendments to working hours. So the citation, if anyone wants to read the case, is on the slide there. It involves Dobson and North Cumbria Integrated Care NHS. In this case, a flexible working was an arrangement in place for Miss Dobson to only work Wednesday and Thursday. A requirement was then placed on Miss Dobson to work weekends, and that was a maximum of one weekend a month. She refused this, and after a little bit of backwards and forwards, she was ultimately dismissed. Miss Dobson brought a claim to the Newcastle Employment Tribunal and was unsuccessful in front of Judge Langridge. She appealed this. The case went before the president of the EAT, Mr. Justice Chowdhury, and he ruled that the tribunal should have taken judicial note of the fact that women bear the greater burden of childcare responsibilities compared to men. The Employment Appeals Tribunal also determined that the pool for comparison was not just the community nurses in Miss Dobson's team, but actually all of the community nurses within the trust. So when we look at indirect discrimination, we can look at a matter called justification, and the justification point wasn't determined by the Employment Appeals Tribunal. And the justification was whether or not there was a need for all staff to work at least one weekend a month. The case has been sent back to the Employment Tribunal to make a new determination in light of what the Employment Appeals Tribunal said. And it'll be interesting to keep an eye on that one. David, could I have the next slide, please? Another question that's come in this week is the hybrid working model. And there is actually a podcast about this on our website as well, if you want to have a bit more detail about it. So in terms of informal steps, employers considering flexible or hybrid working should have an open conversation with employees about flexible working arrangements. Ultimately, this will lead to a discussion about which roles can and cannot be done from home, and actually who may or may not want to work from home. As an employee, you can then establish if there are any concerns and how best to handle them. Now, one thing to bear in mind is if the working location changes to home in the employer's contract, then you need to be mindful about employees claiming travelling expenses when coming to the office or what you deem to be other places of work. You'll also need to consider whether you're going to do this on a trial or if it's going to be a full-time permanent change. If it is a permanent change, you will need to amend the contracts to reflect the change. So when it's a contractual change, it will ultimately be more difficult to go back to the old working arrangement if you feel it's not working for you. If it's a temporary change, the best thing to do is to follow everything up in writing and make sure both parties understand the obligations. If you are going to introduce the hybrid working model, one thing that you really do need to consider is a rework of your policies and procedures. This is going to include things such as how you're going to carry out risk assessments if the employee is working from home, who will provide and pay for equipment, how the home worker will be managed, how things like expenses, tax and information security are handled, and actually your approach to home working. Do you have any flexibility in hours? How are you going to manage that? You also need to make sure the employee is aware that just because they're working from home, they're still covered by the working time regulations, and they also need to undertake their contractual hours. If I could have the next slide, please, David. Another question we received was whether or not staff who don't want to return to the office can be compelled to do so. Now, the starting point is always going to be the contract of employment. What does it say as your place of work, and what does it say about you working in alternate workplaces? Secondly, why does the member of staff want to remain at home? Is it full-time? Is it part-time? How are they looking to manage this? And as an employer, why do you want your employee to return to the office? The third thing to note is if the contract confirms the place of work is the office and you want your employee in the office, it is reasonable to expect them to return. But like anything involving COVID-19 and the word unprecedented gets battered around quite a lot, conversations really should be taking place. Now, the reason for wanting to remain at home might fall within a protected characteristic. So your employee circumstances might have changed. They might have developed a medical condition, for example, or there might be additional childcare issues that they need to be considering. You also need to consider how the employee has worked throughout the period that we've gone through the last 18 months. If your employee has worked efficiently and her productivity hasn't been impacted, it might be much harder to justify a return to the office. There is, however, something to be said for camaraderie and team spirit with being in the office, but whether or not it will be a justifiable reason to expect your employee to return will be subjective. Each case is going to be taken on its own individual merits, and we'd always suggest you get advice on that. The next thing to consider, and it's been in the Telegraph this week actually, is about health and safety. So in particular, Section 44 of the Employment Rights Act. For those of you who attended our seminar last year, I spoke in some detail about Section 44 and where it can be triggered. So this section, which is getting battered around in the media, protects against detrimental treatment if an employee leaves a work situation if they feel there's serious and imminent danger. Now, a lot of journalists have suggested that not having your vaccine and travelling on public transport could fall within that caveat. Now, this could, and I believe it to be highly subjective and highly case sensitive, be correct. It could link to an employee who's yet to receive the vaccine, who goes into a workplace with limited controls and increased exposure. And there could be concerns about travelling on public transport, but it's not always going to fall within this section. I would always suggest it's advisable to take advice if an employee raises any health and safety concerns, because the risk in getting it wrong can result in claims for detriment or automatic unfair dismissal to which there's no defence. You need to handle them very carefully. If I could have the next slide, please, David. It's also important to note that your staff may exercise their right to work flexibly as an alternative to working in the office full time. So if we look at the next slide, flexible working requests come in different shapes and forms. So they could fall within reducing hours to work part time, changing start and finish times, having flexibility with your start and finish times, working compressed hours, job sharing and remote working. Now, to make a request for flexible working, it is a statutory procedure, so there are very strict guidelines on this. So to make a request, your individual who you have in the workplace must be an employee, so that's not an agency worker, and they must have worked for you for at least 26 weeks. An employee can only make one formal flexible working request in any 12-month period. So I've covered that on the slide there. If we could look at the next slide, David. Now, flexible working requests are covered by a statutory process and the means by which is on the screen here. If anybody would like a copy of this, by all means, just email us after this Q&A. As an employer, if you accept the request, and this amends key contractual terms such as location, pay, hours, holiday, etc., it must be followed up in writing. An amendment to the contract must be made. And the final slide, you don't always have to accept a flexible working request. And if it's related to remote working, it will likely fall under the inability to meet customer demand or quality and performance of work. You need to assess each individual on their own merits, and you need to consider the impact on your business. Right, that is a bit of a whistle-stop tour of returning to work. And if anybody needs any further advice in relation to any matters that either Fiona and I have discussed today, please don't hesitate to get in contact with us. I'll pass you back to Fiona, who will close off the Q&A.
Fiona, sorry, can you just unmute yourself?
Apologies, guys. Sorry, I was on mute there. So, so sorry about that. Yeah, thank you very much, Angela. Just so you're aware, the firm's working extra hard to produce and deliver useful and relevant content, articles, blogs, podcasts, and videos, all of which can be found on our website at www.sintons.co.uk. Should you wish to take a look. This includes all episodes of these Q&A sessions. You can also follow the employment team on Twitter at SintonsHR. If you'd like to discuss anything raised today further, or if you have any other employment or any other legal inquiry, please don't hesitate to get in touch. Details of our speakers are on the screen. Our next session will be Friday, the 27th of August at 10 a.m. and our talented and delightful marketing team will send the link for the next session round to you nearer the time. So from me and Angela, thank you very much for listening. I do apologise for the mute blunder there. So we nearly managed to get through the whole thing without any major gaffes, but never mind. Thanks ever so much for listening and stay safe, everyone. Goodbye.